Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. This is a day we talk about the management of colorectal cancer with Dr. Michael Oberman from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. We have a great faculty for this series, and later on we'll show you the results of a poll we did of the faculty of their usual treatment practices. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We have a very brief one-minute survey that we'd like you to take right now in the beginning of the meeting and also at the end of the meeting. Help us figure out what you know and how we can help you know more. We do webinars all the time. Next Tuesday, we're starting a series on soft tissue sarcoma with Dr. Van Tuym. Haven't talked about that lately, so I'll be curious to see what's going on there. And then the week after, we're heading out to ASCO for our usual weekend spectacular. We're starting out on Friday. All these programs, if you're not at ASCO, will be a simulcast live. And we'll also send it out later on replay. We'll start out with GI cancers, then small cell lung cancer Friday night at ASCO, hepatobiliary. Saturday night will be really a wild program focused on prostate cancer, talking about the EMBARK study just presented at the AUA meeting. And we'll talk about ovarian cancer, CLL, lymphoma, myeloma on Sunday night, bladder cancer, breast cancer on Monday night, and we'll finish out with renal cell cancer and talk a little bit about what happened at ASCO. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars and everything else we do. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program on GI cancers, or gastroesophageal cancers. Today, we're here to talk about colorectal cancer. As in all parts of oncology, so much going on. There's a lot to talk about. As we always do in this series, we have a bunch of oncologists who have cases from their practices that we're going to present. Then we'll go through some of Dr. Oberman's papers and publications. We put an appendix in there, too, with a bunch of great slides for you to check out later. But Mike, I want to just start out a little bit with a couple of papers. Before we get started, a couple of papers that I noticed that you were involved with. Two, looking at sort of what's happened over the last 20 years in terms of outcomes or particularly survival with metastatic disease. Can you kind of summarize? You know, we know that about almost 30% of our audience is pretty new to oncology, been in oncology less than 10 years. Can you kind of reflect back on what's happened over the last really 20 years in terms of metastatic colorectal cancer and how that's translated to the patient?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, it's good to see, right? I think we've kind of seen a lot of improvements over the years. And I think we've kind of looked at this a few different ways and stratified it into, you know, additional new agents that we can use. A lot of those tend to be molecular stratified, but we've definitely increased the number of agents when you go back, you know, decades, and that's made a big impact. I think the other one we've seen pretty consistently is the increased use of metastectomy, right? So aggressive kind of surgery of the oligometastatic patient. And you can really trace those two things to have pretty direct correlation to the improvement in outcomes that we see over kind of the vast kind of, you know, decade long kind of timescales.
So to be continued, hopefully in the future, maybe things will be even brighter. That would be great. So I want to get started. We're going to talk in a few minutes about MSI high, but we put together a bunch of papers about checkpoint therapy in general colorectal cancer that I wanted to kind of get into. One is the issue, and we hear this debated in many different cancers, whether or not there's a correlation between adverse effects, immune adverse effects, and outcomes. And you also had some great graphics in there in terms of the incidence and severity of immune-related side effects, and also the time sequence. Can you kind of summarize, first of all, the question of whether there's a relationship to efficacy outcomes, and also some of these other sort of refinities of immune-related adverse events?
Yeah, no, so correct, Neil. We've I think focused on that subset in colorectal space where we have immune response, right? So the deficient mismatch repair group, we've been treating those patients with PD-1 based therapies for a while now, and I have actually done a number of efforts to kind of look back at those data sets to try to understand, you know, what's driving kind of benefit and what correlations we can see. And so one is actually looking at the immune adverse events and seeing how that correlates with activity. And we definitely see a correlation with activity, though there is again, there's some rare event numbers here, so it's a little bit hard to know for sure, but certain immune-related events seem to have a stronger correlation with improved outcome than other ones, right? Which is a little bit interesting. I think classically, we would say you have an immuniverse event that correlates with a good outcome, and I think that's kind of generally true, but it appears to be more true for the more common ones, so your skin and your endocrinology kind of immune-related adverse events, where some of the rare, more severe ones, we don't necessarily see that strong correlation with outcome when you kind of look in a multivariate type model. And then here is just kind of, the occurrence over time, right? There is kind of a little bit of a peak early on where you see a lot of kind of the median onset time can be kind of in that early kind of, 4 month kind of period, but there are some of those weird ones that do kind of linger over time, right? So I always tell patients, it's always good to get out of that first few month period where I think there's a little bit higher risk of running into certain immuniverse events, but you still have to be very cognizant if something happens that's persistent and unusual during immune therapy in year two, then call me, right? My most dramatic case was a myositis, immune myositis at around the 2 year mark, right? Done great for 2 years and then dramatic immune myositis at 2 years, needing hospitalization and everything. So, that's just the one comment you have to be a little cautious of.
Speaking of that, I'm just kind of curious, how long do you keep a thyroid screening going in your patients? Do you keep it going after they stop, for example?
Yeah, a great question, Neil. Yeah. So I often will try to do one kind of after they stop. I don't, as a practice, do it for longer than that. I think you are right. There has been reported kind of delayed effects. There's no doubt about that. But I tend to do kind of one post and then I stop.
So we're really getting some great questions and cases in the chat room. I'll hold it for a second, but we're going to get to them. What about the antibiotic exposure? I see papers on that. I think I just saw one. I think it was in renal cell that was positive. What's the bottom line? What's the idea behind it, the connection between antibiotics, the microbiome, and IOs?
Yeah, no, I think so. So one, there's been a known kind of correlation with antibiotic exposure and kind of immune-related kind of responses across various different tumor types that's been reported. And so here's one we look at in kind of the MSI high space. So I think that's one. That the other one I think that's more dramatic, Neil, is the melanoma data where you take, the microbiome from a responder patient, infuse it into a non-responder patient, right? So someone that progressed on PD-1 and all you do is change the microbiome and it makes them a responder, right? There's two great kind of data sets on that in science, a few years ago, asking, mouse-related data that looked fantastic, but in patients proving it's the case, right? And so I think that's the data that really is more dramatic from our side. And at Anderson, we actually have a study doing that same thing in the MSI space, right? So if you're an MSI high patient progressed on PD-1, we take responder microbiome and infuse it into that non-responder and then keep going with the PD-1.
So like, how do you infuse it?
Yeah. So we do a colonoscopy kind of infusion. So you collect the product, frozen product, you kind of clear it, and then you kind of infuse it with a reverse colonoscopy. So you kind of go all the way in, you prep it clean, and then you on the way out, you kind of trail out the new microbiome on the way out. Yeah.
I can't believe, I talk to you people all day, all the time, and every day I hear stuff I've never heard of, or probably the whole audience has heard about that, but that is amazing. Here's another thing I never saw before, ascites and resistance to a checkpoint inhibitors. What's the deal there?
Yeah, no. So, I mean, again, this is one of these ones where we, dove into kind of the MSI space to look at a lot of different kind of factors on what kind of, correlates with good and bad outcome. And I think, one of the ones was this notation of ascites, really had a strong correlation. And I think potentially, that peritoneal correlation potentially is kind of what was driven behind it. And I think just kind of a note that, on that, could you add other factors into the decision-making in regards to kind of intensification and deficient mismatch repair, right? I mean, that's kind of the question that this gets at, right? Do I do mono or do I do doublet, right? And how do you guide that? How do you know what to do a little bit? And so I think that's a factor that one could put at least on from that data set onto the list of sides of pushing you more to the aggressive side of the doublet choice.
And, you know, here's another paper, you know, this always comes up. Everybody expects MSI high patients to respond. And sometimes they don't, you know, and, what do we know about, what's going on in that situation? And in general, what's going on people who respond or don't respond to IOs in general?
Yeah, no, I think a really interesting area, because it kind of, you know, again, kind of helps guide how we should be treating these patients, right? I think a lot of different efforts have looked into this. And I think it's not crystal clear. I think you've seen different kind of data points from different data sets, but definitely you have an innate resistance group. There's kind of no doubt about that. And that tends to be the bulk a little bit, right? There is some adaptive resistance, but a lot of what we see is kind of innate. So if you respond out of the gate, you tend to really keep responding. And it's fairly rare when you lose that. When you do lose that adaptive resistance, there are some interesting patterns we're seeing where people, you know, adrenal mets, brain mets, you know, kind of, you know, some, you know, ovarian met, you know, sanctuary site kind of metastatic kind of failure. A lot of time in the adaptive space, it also is kind of a heterogeneous kind of adaptive resistance, where I've seen a number of cases where it's one area that for whatever heterogeneous molecular kind of distribution is more resistant. And so you can kind of actually have success by focusing in on some areas. It's not like if they progress in chemo, you know, once site starts progressing, then everything kind of follows, right? That's the chemo story. But in this immune space, that's not necessarily the case. So you can have a few spots that seem to escape that can escape and progress. And often, you know, local modality to those kind of resistant spots can be a benefit for us. So that's kind of the pattern-based effort. I think, you know, trying to pick it up front, you know, we've looked a lot at, you know, TMB is a real common one that people have looked at, Lynch versus non-Lynch, RAS status, BRAF status, you know, a lot of these. I think I'm not sure there's a real clean answer. I think there is some suggestion that RAS mutation seems to kind of portend kind of a little bit worse response, though not dramatically so. I think there has been some interesting data on TMB, and I think the best data I've seen on TMB is this idea of kind of a threshold level. So if your TMB in one data set that I thought was pretty good is less than 12, that appears to be suggestive of a lack of response. If you're over 12, then you respond. But and so the interesting thing there is if you're 30, if you're 50, if you're 90, it doesn't matter. You just have to be kind of over that threshold. Because if you look at TMB as just kind of just high, low, it doesn't matter. But if you threshold it, it does.
I want to get to these cases in the chat room as well. Let me just throw one out to you that I see in the chat room before we go to the first case. 53-year-old woman, this is from Uzoma, history of stage 3B cervical cancer, treated with radiation therapy 1997, now has a PT4B N0, 0 out of 17 nodes, MSI high, wild type BRAF, sigmoid colon cancer. Tumor extends to the pelvic sidewall with gross residual, unresectable disease, PET CT negative. Start IO? How long to use IO? How to monitor for response?
Yeah, so great case where IO before surgery probably would have been like the best move to do, right? Because then you would be able to kind of track your disease and be able to follow it. And then the upside of, you know, maybe you don't need a surgery, right? In kind of a real complicated surgical setting. I think you have residual disease, right? So you have, it sounded like, you know, gross positive margin on the pelvic sidewall. I think IO would be a fine approach there. I think the challenge, if you can't really radiographic see it, or you don't have a CA to watch, you know, kind of response, then it's a little bit hard to know what, you know, is it working or not? The assumption is it is. You know, ctDNA would be another kind of interesting way to kind of get an objective marker you could follow. And so I think one, if you got an objective marker you can follow, I probably would like that and probably do a period of, you know, IO therapy. If not, you know, I might wait a little bit and then pull the trigger when I can actually follow something. I think it'd be a little bit, you know, that the adjuvant IO is makes some logical sense, but we don't have a great data set to support that at all, right? It doesn't exist. You know, so that's where if I saw disease, it would probably help me kind of tell me how long to do it. I think in general, you know, localized settings, we kind of follow the 6-month paradigm, right? I think that kind of is logical extrapolation. Is that right or not? That's kind of a you know, what we do. I think the metastatic setting, you know, we tend to do more kind of 2 years, 1 year would be the data sets you can use to kind of base it off of. You know, this is kind of an unusual case situation. And so I think, you know, ideally I'd follow something and kind of get negative maybe 6 months if everything went away early, maybe a year if it took a lot longer to kind of get negative, would be kind of my ballpark sense.
So and Dr. Malady in the chat room wants to know if you have any thoughts on the young colorectal cancer patients under age 50, no underlying genetic abnormalities in terms of potential etiologies. Again, I hear people talking about microbiome, and clearly we're seeing a lot of young patients. Do you have any thoughts about what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really relevant, you know, interesting, needed question. I think the field does put a lot of weight and hope in the microbiome space, right? I think that's an area we're gaining knowledge and understanding, and there's a clear interplay between inflammation, immune system, and microbiome, no doubt about that. And so clearly there could be a real role that plays there once we understand it. I think, you know, part of the directionality in that regard is that we've looked pretty well at the molecular basis, right? And there are some changes, but not really any that are dramatically so that would kind of give you a clue in regards to kind of the different kind of reasons for why you're seeing such a higher rate in the younger patients than we have in the past. So I think an area of a lot of investigation, and I do think microbiome is one of the top ones that people are looking at. But again, you know, the problem with microbiome is it's really complex. There's a lot of, you know, different bacterial species in there. And so there's a lot of correlation that happens, but you know, what is the causation is really where the field is trying to sort that out.
All right, let's get into these cases that we have. And actually, there's a case in the chat room a lot like this first case. So first, let's see this one from Dr. Brenner, 44-year-old woman, MSI high, colorectal cancer, metastatic to the brain, gets pembrolizumab, also has a KRAS G13G and somatic BRCA. Patient actually had an incredible response like a lot of these patients. Here's Dr. Brenner's questions.
All the systemic disease had basically resolved. So she's having a fantastic response to the pembrolizumab. So my question for the investigators are, we know that pembrolizumab is most likely the standard approach for mismatch repair deficient stage 4 colorectal cancer. But what is the role for ipi and nivolumab for MSI high patients? Other questions are, how long should we treat these patients for? Do we treat them if the disease is controlled for set number of cycles, such as 2 years, which we generally do in lung cancer? Do we treat till best response and discontinue therapy, or do we treat indefinitely? Is there a role for chemotherapy plus IO therapy, especially if high disease burden in MSI high patients with metastatic colorectal cancer? Is there a role for IO therapy in patients who have microsatellite stable colon cancer, particularly those patients who may have a high tumor mutation burden greater than 10? I've treated 3 or 4 patients with MSI high colon cancer in the last couple of years, and all of them are in long-term remission.
So here's a related question that we asked the faculty on this slide here. What's your usual treatment of MSI high? If we could put that up there. And while most people, and at least in the faculty, say Pembro, interestingly, you say Ipi-Nivo.
Yeah. So a bit biased maybe, Neil. You know, I've done a lot of work in that space and pretty familiar with using that combination. So there's a little bit of just comfort from that. I do think the IPI every 6 weeks, which is the regimen we publish on the front line, is a lot more tolerated. I think there's other data sets outside suggesting that does improve tolerance. I think I don't have a problem with monotherapy as well. I think the argument I do make, Neil, is that it is pretty clear, as that person just discussed, we are curing patients with metastatic disease who are deficient in mismatch repair, and we give them PD-1 based therapy, right? There is, you know, we presented 5-year follow-up last year at ASCO, and there is a cure, you know, a tail on that cure at 5 years where they're cured, right? And so, and if you look at the cross-trial comparison, that curve is higher with combo than mono. Now it's, you know, I mean, cross arms, and so not randomized and all that. But, you know, the argument I make is that we do a lot for cure, right? I mean, that's the whole adjuvant, you know, paradigm where we do a lot for cure. And if we're actually talking about really raising a cure fraction, I think a little more toxicity for improvement in cure fraction is a pretty reasonable balance to have, right? And so I think that's where the idea of being more aggressive comes from. I think the counter is, you know, we do monotherapy, it doesn't work, and I salvage it with doublet, right? That approach sounds pretty good to me. We don't really have any data to say that works, though there's some anecdotal data that Nevo Ipi works after a PD-1 progression, right? So I think there's some anecdotal data to support that. But I think, you know, bottom line, I think PD-1 based therapy is the right answer here. And I think that's appropriate. I do think there's an argument for being aggressive because PD-1 does work well. But, you know, if you look at the data with combination, the progressive disease rate is lower. You know, the PFS rates do look higher, again, cross-trial comparisons and all those caveats, but it does appear that way, right? And I think one of the questions that person asked, you know, big bulky disease, you know, do you do chemo and IO? You know, that's under investigation. So there is a frontline study, the GI-004 NRG study, SWOG-1610, looks at atezolizumab versus FOLFOX-BEV atezolizumab, kind of asking that question. I would say if you look at the Nevo-Ipi rates in regards to kind of progressive disease, Nevo-Ipi and refractory and frontline progressive disease was 10 to 15%, right? That's your progressive disease fraction. If you look at the chemotherapy arm in KEYNOTE-177, you're kind of in that same area. You know, you're kind of 15%, 20%. So, you know, a little bit, I think combination immuno is a very more aggressive approach that kind of addresses some of that concern on you know, having to debulk or kind of be concerned about progression fraction, right? It definitely lowers that progression fraction, I think, is one approach to go in that direction.
So, yeah, you know, I think general oncologists are always thinking about other situations and comparing it. It kind of sounds a little bit like, in a way, it reminds me of PD-1 high metastatic lung cancer, where in general, people want to use just, you know, PD-1 or therapy. But they'll think about using chemo plus PD-1 if the patient's very symptomatic. They feel like if the patient progresses in the next few months, they might not be able to salvage the patient. Are there situations where you would add chemo in an MSI-high patient, or are you just going to stick with your ipi/nivo?
Yeah, you know, so I don't do that. You know, I think there is some like phase one data that's safe to do. I don't think we have a lot of large data sets saying that approach. You know, what's the outcome of that approach? I think we do it in a lot of different other tumor types, right? So I think by analogy, it's a reasonable approach. I do think, you know, if you look at the data, you know, doing combination Nevo-Ipi gets you really similar to likely what you see with chemo. And so I think that's a really good combination to take. And I do think in the case where you may not be able to get to, you know, other therapy, I you know, if you said there's one thing you wanted to give a deficient mismatch repair patient, it's got to be immune therapy, right? You know, I mean, the upside is just so tremendous. And so I think if you're going to be aggressive, you know, because people say, well, I'm going to debulk him with, you know, FOLFIRINOX, and then I'm going to give them, you know, kind of immune therapy afterwards. And I'm almost like, why not just start with aggressive immune therapy a little bit, Neil?
I don't know if you follow GYN cancers, but, you know, just a few weeks ago at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology, they had two phase three trials reported on metastatic endometrial. They had MSI high and MS stable, but it was interesting that, so now they're looking at chemo plus IO, but they don't have any data on IO alone that I know about in MSI-high endometrial cancer. So, I mean, I guess that'll be the future, but it's interesting how different tumor types, you see different strategies. Just to continue with the MSI-high theme here, we have another patient, a 59-year-old woman who's a patient of Dr. Eric Lee. This patient, I also saw a couple questions in the chat room about that, also has a BRAF V600E mutation. So I want to ask you about that later too, particularly in the metastatic setting. But this is an adjuvant case. And here's Dr. Lee's questions.
This is a 59-year-old woman, stage 3B colon cancer. She was MSI high, and she also had a BRAF V600E mutation. And so that suggested more of a sporadic tumor than a Lynch syndrome. And so because she was a 3B patient, I started her on Zelox adjuvant chemotherapy. So my questions are, it's kind of understood that MSI-high colon cancers can be resistant to fluoropyrimidines. Is there any data on the use of adjuvant immunotherapy for MSI-high non-metastatic colon cancer? That's question number one. In a metastatic setting, we do use a combination therapy for BRAF V600E mutated colon cancer, and cetuximab and encorafenib. Is there any data for the use of BRAF targeted therapy in the adjuvant setting in this case? This patient was started on standard adjuvant chemotherapy.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I great questions. There isn't any kind of data on the adjuvant space, right? So, I mean, that's kind of the answer. We don't have it. I will say the ATOMIC study, which is the adjuvant MSI high colon cancer stage 3 study, has completed enrollment, and probably in a few years we'll have a readout on that. And that was kind of looking at, you know, stage 3 division miss repair, FOLFOX versus FOLFOX atezolizumab, right? So kind of adding atezolizumab, a PD-L1 into your FOLFOX is kind of adjuvant approach. And so that data set will kind of answer that question. I tend not to do that just because I think we don't have a lot of data. I think sometimes, you know, I'm not sure insurance is going to give you adjuvant use of agents that don't really have an evidence base behind it. So that is where I really, you know, the argument I always make there, Neil, is neoadjuvant, right? I mean, I think we're going to get into this a little bit later, I'm sure. But, you know, the neoadjuvant data, when you look at rectal, is just, you know, astounding. There's other data sets that look really good when you give it before, you know, a surgery or give it early. And so, you know, I think the problem is we don't often know they're deficient misread repair until surgery, right? Because we don't test it on the biopsy. But in theory, one way to give a stage 3 patient PD-1 would be to consider doing it neoadjuvantly, right? I think that's something that's more kind of debatable and something you can do when you say, you know, the guidelines are a little bit, you know, locally advanced, you know, you can kind of use it. And so that's a space where I think you can give your neoadjuvant and, you know, to your kind of locally advanced patient when you can't do it adjuvantly. Because I completely agree. I think, you know, if you look at Foxtrot, which was the neoadjuvant full Fox study from you know, the United Kingdom, the deficient misread repair subset had almost very limited tumor regression. It was almost close to the group that went straight to surgery, right? So what activity are we having in localized with adjuvant? I'm not sure based on the Foxtrot data, right? So I do think it's something to consider, and that would be kind of my angle to try to address this question. But after the situation where surgery is done, I think you are kind of, the standard is what you did. And I think that is kind of what we would say is appropriate.
So speaking of neoadjuvant therapy, particularly of rectal cancer, everybody's familiar with the Memorial study. Now, I think I've heard they're up to 30 patients. They've all responded. But you were telling me you have a series of patients like that also, neoadjuvant therapy. What did you see there? And is that something that you would do outside a clinical trial if you could?
Yeah, no. So I think, there's been a few different, you know, data sets. You know, there's a data set from China. There's the niche data that was from, you know, Europe. That was Nivo-Ipi and then surgery. We published pembrolizumab, neoadjuvant, deficient misread repair, tumor agnostic study. So it had kind of, you know, gastric, endometrial, colorectal. And again, really high kind of response rates. When patients went to surgery, really high path CR rates. Our study was potentially watch and wait. So a number of patients are watching and waiting. We did see progression. So 35 patients, and we saw 6 progression events over the totality of the entire study, right? So 6 out of 35, still a pretty low number. 2 of those were pancreas patients, right? So the 2 pancreas progressed. So, you know, pancreas tends to be a tougher space, even in the MSI high space. And then 1 of those patients was probably a proficient mismatch repair that we misclassified, right? So if you look at the colorectal, it was, I think, you know, 2 out of 27. So I do think a really low rate, Neil, right? I don't think it's 100%, but I think we're in that kind of 90%, you know, kind of net to 100% progression rate. So the vast majority of patients do well. And I think the data sets are pretty clear. When you give immune therapy earlier, before you develop that immune evasion that occurs when you become metastatic, it works better. I mean, all these data sets say the same thing. And so there's no doubt about that. And so I do think it's actually a very reasonable thing to consider. And the easy one is the locally advanced patient, right? I mean, that's the case where I think you can make it really easily, you know, where your margin's a little uncertain, where it's like really, you know, heavy lymph node burden. I think that's a great case to kind of make the argument for kind of a neoadjuvant PD-1 based approach.
All right, a couple of cases from Hassan in the chat room. And first, I'll show you from the survey, just in terms of BRAF therapy that we were just talking about. Investigators, this is what we call a consensus. When everybody does the same thing, we call it a consensus. And here, same thing in terms of the treatment. Before we get to the next case, though, Hassan in the chat room has 2 interesting cases. Here's the first one. 38-year-old T4N0 presents with obstructive left sigmoid tumor. MSI high, any adjuvant therapy? Her Signatera test is negative.
Yeah, I mean, I like the Signatera test, right? I think we didn't talk about it in the last case, but, you know, a lot of times, you know, a positive ctDNA test, especially a tumor informed, to me is kind of, you know, metastatic equivalent, right? I mean, that's an argument I think one could make that's pretty sound. You know, we could talk a little about that, but I think that's a pretty fair statement where the chance of recurrence is exceptionally high and would kind of then let you kind of trigger and actually do, you know, is it adjuvant or is it kind of, you know, micrometastatic disease, you know, that argument. But I think that'd be a very appropriate place to kind of pull the trigger and do it. And I do like that approach in doing it. I think the problem, we just don't have data in the adjuvant otherwise, you know, in a non-selected kind of colorectal patient where you had a resection, we just don't have data that adjuvant works. I think, you know, we're going to get the data. It's going to come. I think the challenge is going to be chemo and immune therapy, right? PD-L1. And so, you know, I think the question is still going to remain, do you need the chemo, right? And I kind of would make the argument, I'm not sure you do, right? You know, but I think, you know, we will have data in time. But right now, I think the best approach, if you don't do it neoadjuvantly, is to do a ctDNA and try to use that as your rationale to kind of go there.
30-year-old woman who is 20 weeks pregnant, has a rectal cancer stage 3, post-resection, positive nodes, mesorectal excision. How to approach therapy now, 22 weeks.
Yeah, so still pregnant? Is that what?
Yes, 20, yeah. Now, yeah.
That's a difficult one. I don't know. That would be a call a friend one for me a little bit, right? Yeah, I have to Neil. Yeah, don't know. You know, I think, I think 5-FU, I am pretty sure, has been looked at and is actually something that can be done. I think there's some question over, you know, trimester and which time you're doing it. But I would have to kind of look into kind of our kind of breast group, right? They're the group that tends to have the most experience kind of in this space and kind of discuss what they've seen. You know, I think PD-1, I have a little concerns. I don't know how much data we have there in kind of the pregnant space. And I think there would be some concerns. Could that cause kind of harm? I'm not entirely sure that's safe. So I think a little bit my general sense would be thinking 5-FU to kind of, you know, hold things at bay, have delivery, and then maybe after that regroup and kind of try to escalate kind of at that point.
Yeah, the chat room says 5-FU should be fine. You know, incidentally, one of the most common reactions we get to our work is people feel comforted when they see investigators struggle because they know they're not alone out there, you know. And speaking of tough cases, here's Dr. Diani, who has a 72-year-old woman, history of diverticulitis, partial colectomy, but diagnosed with a T1 MS stable cecal colon adenocarcinoma, status post endoscopic resection, who's now MRD negative. Here's Dr. Diani.
She is the mother of one of our nurses, very early stage disease, cecal adenocarcinoma. The T1 adenocarcinoma, moderately differentiated, completely resected. Invasive component was 1.5 millimeter, no margins, no LVI, no perineal invasion, microsatellite stable. So it was invasive adenocarcinoma, very early stage, completely resected through endoscopic means. Then she was referred from our GI colleagues to colorectal surgery, and we presented that patient at tumor board. The question is, what do you do? Is this appropriate management or does she need more? Do you do hemicolectomy? The second question is, especially if you consider surveillance for this lady, what would be the role of molecular residual disease tumor-informed ctDNA assay for this patient? Would you use a negative baseline test in support of observation, or would that not sway you either way? You would still aggressively treat her. And how would you monitor this patient if you would monitor this patient with MRD ctDNA assays?
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the classic answer would be you would do a resection for kind of full lymph node staging, right? I mean, that's kind of the classic answer, Neil. You know, I think, you know, T1, you know, I'd be interested to know kind of how much the invasion went, the depth, right? There's some data on kind of depth of invasion in regards to stratifying your T1s. You know, so that's one thing you can look at if you had that. You know, yeah, the risk of having lymph node mets, the risk of recurrence is fairly low here, right? And so I think, you know, an observation approach is not unreasonable. I think the counter would be, you know, if you did a full resection, then you really are more certain about that, and you have a better sense of what you're dealing with. I do think it's not, you know, unreasonable if someone's going to surveil. I do think you probably are doing a greater surveillance effort than you would for a T1 that's fully resected, right? You know, a T1 fully resected, you're kind of done, and you know, you're that's it, but I think in this case, yeah, you would want to do some further follow-up just to make sure, because I don't think you have that nodal assessment, right? So what that looks like, I think ctDNA is a good kind of, you know, potential marker that we're using. You know, I don't think we have enough data to say it should replace other forms of surveillance, right? I think T1 is a space where we don't have a lot of data, right? You know, so how does it function in the really early kind of localized settings? I think that's kind of an area where we have a lot more data when you look at your stage threes, your stage twos, right? So how much to weight it? I think a positive is really helpful in these kind of earlier ones. A negative, I think I'm not sure how much that really shifts you a little bit in these earlier stage patients. And so I think, you know, that's just a discussion, I think, you know, at multidisciplinary, as kind of was alluded to, and kind of with the patient and kind of deciding which path to go.
So we were talking about circulating tumor DNA, and here's the faculty initial thoughts about it. And everybody's using it, some in metastatic disease, but everybody in adjuvant therapy. You say you use it both stage two and stage three. How do you approach these patients, and how do you use this assay?
Yeah, no. So I think we touched on this, but I think there's panel-based testing and there's tumor-informed, right? So I think, you know, tumor-informed is where you sequence the tumor and then kind of look for those mutations specifically in the blood. So I think you have a little better sense when you have a positive test that it's a real kind of positive test, and that's one of the advantages. I think the panel-based testing is really useful more in the metastatic setting. Resistance mechanisms, kind of looking for your general mutation spectrum. I think in the MRD setting, I do think tumor-informed really makes a lot more sense. You're able to have more confidence in kind of the result you have. Yeah, how we use it is a great, you know, discussion topic, Neil. There's a number of studies that are out there, right? So one answer would be to, you know, look at Circulate US, look at COBRA, right, which are studies that look at your stage two and your stage three, kind of escalate, de-escalate kind of questions. You know, I do think it is a really, really strong prognostic factor. There's no doubt about that, right? I think we've seen that. I think some of the data sets do show you can still modulate that with your chemotherapy, right? So we have ability to modulate that. So if you turn someone who's positive, ctDNA positive, to ctDNA negative, their outcome improves, right? So we can modulate the ctDNA status. So I think that's a good point to note. I think we are using it more. I think the biggest challenge is it's very useful. Positive, I think, definitely kind of moves you, right? If you're thinking of treatment versus not, positive moves you into the category of treatment. I think the use of not treating based on a negative, I think that's a space where we need better data to really kind of delineate that. You know, there's been some data sets, the Dynamic, which was in New England Journal of Medicine. But even if you dive in and look at that, the ctDNA negative, there's some difference by clinical factors. So T4 ctDNA negative does worse than T3 ctDNA negative, right? So there is this question of how do we integrate it exactly into kind of some of our historical factors. And I think that's something we're still working through. But a lot of those settings are settings where you've kind of, you know, have a decision in regards to escalating or continuing therapy. I think it can help do that. It is tough to know in some of these. You can do this test and kind of get in a tough spot where it's not clear what to do, Neil. So I do think you have to be a little cautious with the test. You know, if you've already done your adjuvant FOLFOX or CAPOX and it's positive, what do? You know, is more better? I mean, that's kind of our general sense, is more is always better, but there's many cases where we've actually looked at that and more is not better, right? You know, like take your pick from adjuvant colon studies where we added more into it, and they're all negative, right? You know, EGFR, VEGF, FOLFIRI, you know, so I think you have to be a little cautious in when you use it and what question you're asking with it.
So actually we have a case in the chat room where people are asking about, do you use adjuvant therapy after hepatic resection? And actually this question we asked the faculty is interesting in terms of whether or not they use ctDNA in the patient who's had resection. Actually, almost all the faculty does. Any comments about the use of ctDNA in metastatic disease? We actually, the next case is that, but particularly oligometastatic disease, what are some of the situations in metastatic disease where you think it's most valuable?
Yeah, no, I mean, so I think, so, you know, this is one of those kind of, you know, resection-based settings, right? Where there's kind of this idea of, you know, a cure fraction, right? Yeah, you're going after. I think there have been data, you know, in this setting, a lot of the data is not so clear and clean, right? Small sample sizes have kind of limited us to be really conclusive here. I do think, you know, doing it neoadjuvant, we tend to like, I like neoadjuvant therapy before kind of resection. So that's often where we do it. Do you need it adjuvant? How much more do you need adjuvant? You know, is it, you know, do you need 6 months or 3 months, right? All those questions, you know, are kind of unclear in this setting. And so you could use maybe ctDNA to kind of guide you. Do you do 6 months? Well, maybe ctDNA positive, I do 6 months, right? You know, I will say one of the biases and benefits I have at being at a large academic center, Neil, is that we have studies for patients that are positive ctDNA. So a little bit of my cheat answer here is we do a lot of testing because our answer is we have a study, right? So in this case, we would have a study with TAS-102, for example. So, you know, you've done your full FOX neoadjuvantly, patient's positive, what do? We would put them on TAS-102 on study, right? So, you know, I think that's kind of where the, you know, we kind of go often, but I think it can help you. You know, I think the challenge is, you've done, you know, 6 months of full FOX, do you keep doing more, right? Like you start getting these situations where it's unclear what you're benefiting. And so you have to be cautious, but I think MRD is where ctDNA is really useful. You know, I think the other two settings, just real quick, Neil, that we do it is that, you know, we have a lot of studies in frontline. So we have a HER2 frontline study, we have a BRAF frontline study. And so we're doing a lot of ctDNA at the very beginning to get a quick test result. You know, you want to make it, you made a treatment decision-making really fast. You don't have time for that, you know, 1 month molecular result, right? So we do ctDNA sometimes to help guide us in frontline therapy. We do that for IHC now, right? But I think we do that and we'll see more of that coming down the pipe with, you know, some of these data sets that might put HER2 and BRAF into frontline, right? So I think that's a space we see it. We do it, you know, for kind of, I think, EGFR resistance kind of mechanisms, which we may talk about a little bit later in regards to kind of that EGFR rechallenge question, right? So those are probably the big spaces where we see a lot of our use here.
So a couple quick questions related to what you just said. You mentioned your trial looking at TAS-102, not TAS-102 plus Bev?
It's just TAS-102, yeah.
You didn't want to modify it once you saw the phase 3. So, anyhow,
well, it's ctDNA positive, so it's a little bit of this MRD setting. So, I hear you. That would be a reasonable approach too, but we haven't modified it. No.
And then the other thing is it caught my attention. You said first line trial HER2. What are you looking at? Chemo plus?
Chemo plus. Yeah. So I think BRAF plus versus chemo, and then HER2 is the same thing. Chemo plus.
What are you looking at in terms of HER2 plus chemo?
Tucatinib.
Great. So let's go to another case here, a 68-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Viswanathan. She had a history of hypothyroidism, but underwent a colonoscopy in 2018, which showed a tubulovillous adenoma in the sigmoid colon with high-grade dysplasia, suspicious for possible focal invasion, stalk margin negative for dysplasia and invasion, subsequent serial colonoscopies, all negative for anything, but she shows up with a lung mass. Here's Dr. Viswanathan.
And now she has the CT chest, which shows light upper lobe nodule, and a subsequent PET scan, which shows persistent hypermetabolic activity there, but no other distant evidence of metastatic disease. We biopsy this nodule, and it's concerning for colorectal primary. I again do a colonoscopy. Again, no evidence of malignancy, no mass. So she undergoes a segmentectomy, and the final tumor cells, based on the IHC, it's positive for CK20, CDX2, negative for CK7, TTF1, and NAPSIN. So it's more pointing towards a colorectal primary. Questions for this case, the lung nodule seems to be consistent with metastatic colon cancer, no obvious colon mass. How would the experts navigate treatment choice for her? Is there any role for ctDNA testing in this case? If ctDNA is negative, would they hold off on chemo and just do surveillance scans? Or if they would give chemo anyway, regardless of ctDNA, would they consider something like capecitabine in this setting, or would they be comfortable watching this patient?
Any thoughts about this one?
Yeah, good cases, Neil. You bring some good ones.
That's the idea.
Surprise. I mean, you know, if you have a pedunculated polyp with a stalk, and you know, generally, you know, that stalk is margin negative, then you're done, right? So really surprising case. I mean, I think we see unusual things happen. So I mean, I think that is probably the explanation. I do completely agree with the idea of, you know, repeat colonoscopy, making sure you're not missing something else, like, you know, all those things. But it's a little bit hard to argue any other way when you have, you know, kind of the IHC for colon's pretty clear cut, right? So you have a solitary lesion, and you've resected it, your NED now, you know, what do you do? I think, you know, the outcomes with solitary are pretty good, right? That's kind of where we do see some of the better kind of metastectomy type outcomes, right? But there's still a high risk of recurrence, right? So I think one generally would say, you know, we don't have a lot of great data adjuvant metastectomy, but I kind of would say, you know, we haven't given this patient, you know, the 5-FU and oxali, right? A lot of times we see these metastectomies after people have had adjuvant and then they relapse. And then you're like, should I do the same thing again that they already failed before? You know, I think there is some illogicalness in this. I do think I kind of favor the idea of giving somebody a one chance at the best therapy we have. You know, I think, you know, so 5-FU based, I think is pretty reasonable. Yeah, would I do oxali here? You know, maybe not. I'd have to discuss that with the person. But I do probably would favor some Xeloda out of the gate for some defined period of time, you know, 3-6 months, just to kind of give you that adjuvant coverage. I think it's the data sets driving that are a little bit weak. I think the alternative approach is to use ctDNA to guide you. And I think that's a pretty reasonable approach as well. You know, that clearly would be one that would, you know, push you over. I think if the negative, you're comfortable not doing it, right? That would be the question, I think. And I think there's some unknowns, as I talked about in the first decision. I probably would do ctDNA. I probably would still also do Xeloda no matter what is probably my answer. And use ctDNA to escalate the oxali is probably how I would, you know, go about this one, Neil.
So HER2 positive, we've talked about your trial looking at tucatinib up front, but of course right now it's an interesting consideration in metastatic disease. We just did a program at the ONS Congress on HER2 positive disease where we had GI people, lung people, and breast people all on the stage trying to compare notes with what they do, which is what the oncologists are doing. And you'll hear in this case actually a little bit relevant. Here's Dr. Gandhi talking about a 66-year-old lady.
This patient had a rectal metastatic cancer on presentation, liver and lung mets. It was HER2-3+, treated with FOLFOX and bevacizumab. She responded very well initially, and then she had disease progression. So when we switched it to FOLFIRI and cetuximab, she did not respond that well. And that is when I went to DDXD, and there was initial response, and that lasted for 6 months. And then she had disease progression on TDXT. We gave trifluridine and then later on rogorafenib. She has progressed. And I was about to advise hospice. And then I read this new approval of trastuzumab plus tucatinib. So I just started that drug maybe a week ago.
Have you used tucatinib in breast cancer?
I had one patient that I can clearly remember top of my head. She had brain met after we gave the treatment, and I went with tucatinib on that patient with capecitabine, and my goodness, we did not even give radiation. She pulled it on for about 1 year, maybe a little longer, without radiation. Brain met improved by MRI. So I liked it.
A lot of docs in general medical oncology have used the HER-CLIMB regimen. Any thoughts about it? Also, it's interesting that he gave TDXD before tucatinib trastuzumab. I'm sure you noticed that. Any thoughts about the case in HER2-positive colorectal cancer?
Yeah, no, I think he's right. I mean, tucatinib has good kind of CNS penetration, right? So one of the arguments for kind of use is in that setting. I think, you know, HER2 patients, you know, do prolonged therapy HER2. You know, there is some selection for brain mets, right? I mean, that kind of is a correlation we do see a little bit even in the colorectal cancer space. But I think that the unique thing here is that the switch, right? I mean, classically, we do trastuzumab-based combinations, and then we do kind of, you know, trastuzumab deratoxicant. And so the reverse order is interesting, right? Like, I'm not sure if it's going to work or not. You know, I don't think we have a lot of data to answer the question. So I'm kind of really interested to see how that case plays out a little bit. We definitely have clear data the other way, right? Progression on trastuzumab, you know, pertuzumab, trastuzumab, tucatinib, and you do kind of trastuzumab, dirtuximab, you can actually see response, right? So I think that's the more classic direction that we see in regards to use. You know, doing it the reverse direction, I'm not sure. You know, there's, you know, I could argue that one a few different ways, Neil. So I think, but I think I would probably argue the other way because we just have more data there. It doesn't mean this way is necessarily not the right way.
We were talking before about TAS-102, and here's Dr. Brenner again talking about a 66-year-old man with a heavily pretreated metastatic disease. Here are his questions.
At that time, he still had residual neuropathy, so we re-challenged him with FOLFIRI, but unfortunately, again, developed progression of disease and was placed on TAS-102 with the standard 5-day on, 2-day off, 5-day off schedule, and we elected to add bevacizumab to the regimen. So my questions for the investigators are, how do we sequence and decide between TAS-102 and regorafenib? This is a common clinical situation we deal with in practice. We know we like to get patients to try and receive both agents during the course of their disease, but is there a preference for potentially starting with one versus the other? What is the role of bevacizumab in patients who are receiving TAS-102? Is there any role for IO therapy in combination with TAS-102? And what is the role of TAS-102 in frontline therapy? I've also seen some data with a different schedule of TAS-102, including data from Asia looking at a 1 week on, 1 week off schedule. And I'm interested to see if the investigators are using that schedule. And do they have any pearls about the dosing and management for regorafenib related side effects?
Dr. Brenner's a question machine.
He is a question machine. Yeah, I mean, I'll tackle some of those. So we use the redose regimen, right? So that was kind of published looking at regorafenib where you start 80, 120, 160 over kind of weeks. And so that's the regimen we use most commonly. I think a lot of us do TAS bevacizumab, right? The sunlight data was recently kind of presented, and that looked at TAS versus TAS bev, and TAS bev was statistically significant in regards to kind of outcomes. And so I think that kind of has really moved TAS-BEV to really be kind of more the regimen you're going to use prior to kind of regorafenib, just because you have improved activity when you look at kind of that comparison. TAS and rego cross trial look very similar. TAS-BEV is better than TAS. Via, you know, TAS-BEV kind of wins the day and goes first. And so I think that's kind of our kind of directionality and kind of use. I don't think there's any good data with PD-1 combination, you know, frontline data. There's some small data sets, but nothing I would kind of recommend at present. And I think that was all of his questions, Neil. Let me know if I missed one.
Did you get the other way of giving TAS-102 the other?
Oh, yeah,
schedule?
That's right. Yeah, so good point. There's been a lot of different work on TAS-102 and scheduling. If you go back on TAS-102, it's been a drug that's been around for a while, and it's been studied a lot of different ways of giving it. Yeah, the one-off week schedule is one that's been reported. I think there was a good retrospective experience out of Vanderbilt that was actually published that looked at this, that actually had lower kind of heme toxicity rates and more consistent ability to keep people on treatment. I think the question is the efficacy side, right? You know, is it the same? I don't know if we really know the answer to that question. I do think the data looks like that's a more tolerable way to give it. At least from that small retrospective, the data looked pretty good on efficacy, but it's a little bit hard because it's not great efficacy, right? So I think the caveat when you do that is that, you know, it's a little bit uncertain if you've lost a little bit of activity. I mean, that could very well be the case. And TAS-102 is one that is very schedule dependent, given all the historical, you know, looks at how they got to this. I mean, it's a weird regimen, right? You know, Monday to Friday. Like, it doesn't make sense. And that's because they looked at all the common regimens, you know, Neil, and then they came out with this weird regimen. So I'm a little bit cautious with that drug, saying it's always fine to kind of give it different ways, I have to say. But I think if the issue is you're having a lot of trouble keeping somebody on cycle, then maybe it makes sense, right? Because then you kind of give the same amount of dose in the same time frame where you weren't doing that at all before. And so then your kind of dose intensity is higher. And so maybe that kind of makes that uncertainty more of a willing kind of a switch or approach to giving it.
All right, let's see if we can squeeze in another case here. 66-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Lorber, metastatic BRAF V600E mutant colorectal cancer, ctDNA positive, Erfurt Fulfox, HIPEC, and colectomy debulking surgery. Here's the case.
66-year-old woman, she presented with diffuse abdominal pain and was found on imaging to have a large right-sided colonic mass, regional adenopathy, and also peritoneal metastases. She underwent biopsy, which was consistent with colorectal cancer with mucinous features and was notable for a BRAF V600E mutation. She was started on Fulfox. She had symptomatic improvement and underwent HIPEC along with a right hemicolectomy and debulking. Had no disease remaining on imaging, but was still ctDNA positive. She was started on surveillance, but 4 months later, she developed imaging recurrence with peritoneal disease and was started on encorafenib and panitumumab, and thus far has had a partial response to this regimen. She's tolerated it well, some rash, but minimal, not impacting her day-to-day activity. Question is, she will likely progress in the near future on this regimen, and does her BRAF status influence what she should receive next?
So I don't know if you missed it, but she also had peritoneal mets at diagnosis, but all the disease in the belly. Before you get into the BRAF thing, what about HIPEC?
Yeah, no. So, I mean, I think so there's been data sets looking at this, right? And the data has been negative, right? So, I mean, I think, and the question here is that there's two things going on, right? There's cytoreductive surgery and how good your surgery is. And then there's the HIPEC addition, right? I think there's no doubt that cytoreductive surgery is a benefit for patients, right? And I think the question is, you know, above good cytoreductive surgery, do you add something from HIPEC? And the data is fairly negative on that. I mean, there is this kind of Goldilocks kind of area where maybe it helps the intermediate kind of volume amount. But yeah, we're not doing HIPEC on a standard basis for our colorectal patients. We still do it in appendix. Could debate that, but we don't really do it anymore. We just do kind of good, complete cytoreductive surgery, which is center dependent. You need experience when you're doing that. You know, for this question, Neil, yeah, I mean, I think BRAF is kind of a bad prognostic factor, kind of a chemo-resistant prognostic factor, right? I don't know if there's any good data to say, you know, do you go to TAS, do you go to Rego, which one? I'm not sure. I'd not be overly optimistic about either. I definitely strongly think getting BRAF targeting is the right approach. You know, I'd be very tempted to even look in the phase one group to see what else they would have in the BRAF kind of kitchen. You know, what other kind of double down can you do? I would actually probably favor going that direction more than Rego TAS, just knowing the experience. You know, we published some work here at Anderson, our experience with kind of after frontline BRAF, you know, they all look bad no matter what second line or third line you're kind of giving a little bit. They all progress at 2 months is kind of what our data kind of says. You know, there is an interesting kind of, you know, study now through SWOG looking at the immune therapy addition into BRAF, right? So there is some kind of immune therapy context to BRAF and colon cancer. And so I think the other idea would be, you know, phase one where you maybe get an immune therapy in. I think that would be of interest. But that SWOG study is encorafenib, cetuximab plus minus Nevo. And that's what that is.
Thanks so much, Mike. It was really great. I could listen to you all day long. Audience, be safe, stay well, and join us next week. We're going to talk about sarcomas. And it should be fun and interesting. Have a great night.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thanks, Mike.